The Blue Hour, No 36, We Are as Paper by Shara Nova, Far Cry. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky addressed a rare joint session of Congress Wednesday night, where he called on the Biden administration and lawmakers to provide more military and financial aid to Ukraine in its fight against Russia. Zelensky's visit to Washington came 300 days after Russia's invasion on February 24th. It was Zelensky's first overseas trip since the war began. On Wednesday afternoon, President Biden met with Zelensky at the White House, announcing more military aid for Ukraine, including a Patriot missile defense system.
Today, I'm announcing the next tranche of our security assistance to Ukraine, $1.85 billion package of security assistance that includes both direct transfers of equipment to you that Ukraine needs, as well as contracts to supply ammunition Ukraine will need in the months ahead for its artillery, its tanks, and its rocket launchers. Critically, in addition to these new capabilities, like precision aerial munitions, the package will include a Patriot missile battery, which will train Ukrainian forces to operate as part of the ongoing effort to help bolster Ukraine's air defense.
During a speech to a joint session of Congress later in the day, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said aid to Ukraine should be viewed as an investment, not charity.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is listener-sponsored. That's right. 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. You can always make a donation to help keep KBOO independent and non-commercial at kboo.fm/give. Right now, during our end-of-year drive, is the perfect time to contribute. Give now and help us reach our goal of $70,000 by December 31st. Make your tax-deductible year-end donation at kboo.fm/give today.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up in this end-of-year membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, local residents speak out on houselessness and addiction struggles in Multnomah County. Across the border in Washington State, the plan to spend millions to help the houseless. And why are college costs getting so much more expensive? KBOO takes a closer look.
It's just hard, more of the fact, like working like almost three jobs.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 15th, 2022. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Multnomah County Commissioners faced a packed schedule that included issues like setting a new election to replace a member elected to chair, Jessica Vega-Peterson, and a ban on flavored tobacco. But before they could get to those issues, they listened to a long line of people who wanted to talk about what they say is most critical at this time, the issues of homelessness and addiction.
It is time for all government bodies to come together for the common cause of helping our unsheltered neighbors to a better life and keeping Portland from further deteriorating. We must seize the opportunity to work through the new ideas to help solve our homeless crisis and bring dignity back to those living on our streets. These last 2 weeks of our current administration is not the time to be making these decisions that can have significant impacts both currently and long term. It would be prudent for the county to hold off on the consequential decisions about spending surplus funds until next year. This crisis will end sooner with greater collaboration between the county and the city, with greater transparency and accountability to best deploy taxpayer money to assist those who want to participate in their own rescue and work to achieve healthier choices, which will result in better quality of life. In my experience, life moves at the speed of trust. We need the county and the city to work together to create more trust by the taxpayers and other government entities. Thank you for your time.
My name is Dick Perkins. I'm a 16-year resident of downtown Portland. I'm also a recovered heroin addict and an ex-felon who has been active in behavioral health and homeless issues as a volunteer. As someone with lived experience, I interact with unsheltered people experiencing behavioral health issues daily as I walk through downtown. I'm very familiar with the issues surrounding lack of affordable housing, the myriad obstacles the unsheltered face, and how complex they are. There is a pending ADA lawsuit, an increase in homelessness, and, with the implementation of Measure 110, an apparent increase in substance use disorder of some new and more potent drugs. The long-awaited money to fund affordable housing is starting to come in and be deployed, but the level of homelessness and the issues that accompany it are increasing. There is a legitimate difference of opinion between the city of Portland and the county as to what the best strategies are and how to best deal with the related issues of homelessness, behavioral health, and crime. As someone who voted for supportive housing funds and Measure 110 before the pandemic, none of my expectations have been met. We will have a new county chair and a different city council in January. We need to press pause, take the time for the new board and council to listen to each other, gather better data on successes and failures, and let the new board and council make decisions about how the two will work together to address the three interrelated problems. We will never solve this until the city and county have good open communication, coordination, and collaboration.
Good morning, commissioners. For the record, my name is Bridge Crane Charles Simca Johnson, and it's good to be back with you. And we know that thousands of people are sleeping outdoors in tents, and often it's dry right now, but often they end up with wet blankets, and we do not have the capacity to address those needs. I have been in the Behavioral Health Resource Center a few times, so I know that there are some washer and dryer equipment improvements, what's available on top of what's available at TPI, but you know, so much remains to be done. And fortunately, with TikTok and Instagram, we now have Angelita, the PNW policy angel, who I think we can thank for having a little bit bigger turnout here, because just voting for housing bonds is not getting the job done. So we're going to hear many people, I think, signed up on R2 to talk about the chaos that is created when the city goes off on a semi-fact-based thing. Every shelter space that's being talked about for Sam Adams and Ted Wheeler's mass camps is spaces that are needed, but they need to be done in a humane, integrated, sensible way. So as Commissioner Peterson moves up to be the chair, there's going to be some awkward dynamics about this funding for the JOHS, which is under interim director, a different interim director. So I hope that the focus will be, since we can't instantly get housing in the blink of an eye, and we don't know how many people are even getting to the point where they fill out their VSBID app. There is an extensive bureaucratic process to get non-family, I don't know what it's like for families, but for individuals, there is a bizarre bureaucratic process where they get triaged on the VSBID app or they live outside. That's really the reality of the situation. I know there's been some improvement in shelter bed numbers, and all those people, I'm sure, are grateful. But what's behind the bizarre plan from the city is the fact that some people are shelter averse. They would rather be in a tent close to a porta potty and still be able to manage their inventory of bicycles or whatever property without having to be under the property limitations that people face when they're in shelters. Those people that are in shelters, the casework there never really includes helping them. They may have $700 or $800 or more of disability money, but nobody to help them get a storage unit that they might be able to get for $50 or $70 a month where they would feel much safer.
Commissioners, my name is Jarrett Cradone. I currently live in Southeast Portland. I have been in homelessness and drug addiction and severe mental health for the past 5 years, to the point where I was afraid to even interact with humans. All I had was my dog, and I was so just lost in my mind that I couldn't even like take care of myself, to the point of having a blanket or like giving myself food or water. I have been in and out of the system. I have utilized the services here in the city, and I've come to find out that it's greatly lacking. And I'm here to ask you to slow down on your spending, as another individual talked about, and to try and look at this situation that we're going through and look at every human being here as a beautiful human being, not as an addict, because I am not an addict. I am not a homeless individual. I am not the circumstances that my life has fallen into. I can change my life in any given moment with the added support of our community. And I believe in being through the system that we have the resources here, and that we are not looking at this situation and slowing down to really help these individuals in the holistic way that we need. Our community, I believe, is very capable. And we, if we could change our mindset in looking at those individuals in this way, then I just see that our system is not working, and everything falls short in this inhumane way where dogs are being treated better than human beings. And if we could set up like trauma healing centers and really go after the root of things. I mean, trauma just doesn't seem to be discussed, how it's stored in the body, and everything is just a mask. And these systems, most of the organizations that are going on to help people are run short, and they don't have the fundage, and they're having to work 40 or more hours just to pay their bills, and they're running thin. I work in social services myself, and it doesn't need to be like this. If we could slow down on our spending and, you know, look at the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, I think we could really accomplish things. First, for myself, I could not have started healing without housing first, and then good food and added support of our community and people checking in.
And those were some of the comments directed at the Multnomah County Commissioners during their meeting this morning. Washington State is taking major steps trying to curb its growing problems with houselessness. KBOO's Josh Salem has more in the story.
Washington's Governor Jay Inslee just announced that state spending over the next 2 years should prioritize housing. This includes building thousands of new housing units. His proposed budget would spend $70 billion starting in July of 2023. That figure represents about a 12% increase in spending from the current budget, but it does also include other areas like the environment and public safety. Nearly 13,000 people are living unsheltered throughout Washington, up from more than 10,500 in 2020. To address the growing lack of affordable housing, Inslee is proposing the state raise $4 billion by issuing bonds outside the state's debt limit. The money would be spent on emergency supportive housing for unhoused people, affordable housing units, and helping low-income, first-time homebuyers with down payments and closing costs. Inslee said, quote, "Unfortunately, we no longer have the influx of federal funding we are using today to quickly build thousands of new supportive housing units for people experiencing homelessness. I don't want to lose momentum, and I don't want the problem to get worse because we aren't moving fast enough," end quote. The additional monies would pay for about 5,300 housing units between 2023 and 2025, in 19,000 in the following 6 years. The referendum still requires approval from lawmakers and voters. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
A recent report says the time it takes to earn the cost of paying for food, gas, and housing is cutting into many college students' ability to complete their studies. KBOO's Reed Johnson has more on that story.
Covering the cost of a college education just got more expensive, as already stressed students cope with the highest inflation rate in more than 40 years. A new report finds that while direct expenses like tuition and fees are on the rise, so are indirect costs like housing, gas, and groceries. Many students in Indiana and across the nation are working multiple jobs just to pay for life's necessities. Maya Bell is a sophomore at Purdue University Northwest in Hammond. She says her studies as a double major in political science and human development are hard work, but paying for living expenses is becoming harder.
I used to spend $50 on groceries, and now I spend like $100. Gas is crazy. $40 doesn't even get me close to a full tank. I think there's just a lot of smaller factors that impede my academic and my professional work because I'm trying to make enough money to like live.
Bell is a scholarship student who lives in a campus dormitory, but says earning money to pay for items like clothing, car payments, and even vet bills for a cat cut into time she normally sets aside for her studies. A blog post by the National Scholarship Providers Association says to cover higher expenses, many colleges are raising tuition rates and student service fees. All the while, interest costs and tuition loans have almost doubled over the past 2 years. Bell says making ends meet can be a struggle, but she finds creative ways to cope.
It's just hard, more of the fact, like working like almost three jobs, because it doesn't give you enough time to dedicate to school and studying as you would like to. So it's like I'm staying up all night now because I can't really work during the day on my schoolwork.
According to the report, many colleges across the country are making changes to help students save money. Some are allowing students to attend classes virtually one day a week, or providing free public transportation to cut down on commuting costs. Others provide free groceries or have loaner programs for students who can't afford laptops. Bell says she's looking at 3 more years of work before graduation.
I always make it work, but it's not ideally how I want it to work. I have to go to the food pantry at my school, or I have to ask my parents for help. And I've also picked up a side job babysitting, but I don't see myself getting out of the situation anytime soon.
For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Reed Johnson.
Statistics show that college enrollment of male students of color dropped significantly more than other student populations during the pandemic. But some schools bucked the trend at the community college level. Suzanne Potter has more on that story.
During the pandemic, California community colleges lost 19% of their enrollment. But as a new report shows, a handful of schools bucked the trend. Researchers with the Campaign for College Opportunity found that some schools had smaller losses or even added students by focusing on equity and by expanding outreach. Colleen Moore is a higher education consultant who interviewed dozens of college administrators for this study.
All the colleges I spoke with talked about expanding financial supports in some way through things like transportation and book vouchers as a means of helping low-income students stay enrolled.
Suzanne also relied on data analytics to see where students were stopping out and then refined course schedules, curriculum, programs, and institutional policies to better meet student needs. They also increased partnerships with local employers to offer students a path to a job after graduation and tried to create a more supportive campus culture. Moore adds that many of the schools expanded their efforts to reach out to current, former, and prospective students.
Some people talked about explicit efforts to divide up their lists of students to contact based on race or ethnicity and assigning the list to staff that share that background as one aspect of their efforts to make their campus more welcoming to all students.
The 9 schools that either had smaller enrollment losses or added students include community colleges in Barstow, Berkeley, Clovis, Folsom Lake, Moore Park, Sacramento, San Diego, Visalia, and West Hills.
Depression, anxiety, and other mental health struggles were much higher in the LGBTQ plus population during the pandemic, and they remain especially troublesome in young adults. According to numbers released from the U.S. Census Bureau, Mike Moran reports that many are not receiving treatment.
The Census Bureau has released a report that shows LGBTQ people suffered higher rates of depression, anxiety, and other mental hurdles than did the general population during the pandemic. And an Iowa survey has dug a little deeper. The census figures show that 18 to 29-year-olds reported symptoms of anxiety that were almost 18% higher than the general population during the pandemic. A related survey by advocacy group One Iowa shows that 50% of LGBTQ respondents in Iowa report mental health issues as their number one concern. One Iowa project director, Malachi Monyon Sosa, says the problems don't end there.
About 40% of the folks, the LGBTQ Iowans that took that survey, reported being victims of violence, all based on their LGBTQ identity.
The Iowa Health Needs Assessment also showed half of the respondents who reported struggling with mental health issues or seeking counseling, but that a staggering 55% have considered committing suicide, with many of those saying they had plans to do so in the past year. Monyon Sosa says Iowa's aging population has contributed to stagnant attitudes about LGBTQ people in Iowa. He adds that One Iowa is working with state agencies and other advocacy groups to try to end stereotypes that he says are starting to change among young people as alternative lifestyles become more acceptable.
our younger population is becoming more and more diverse. And if we hold on to the notion that everyone will never change and the way that society looks now will be the way that society looks forever, we start to push people who are more diverse to the margins of our society.
The Iowa Health Needs Assessment will be ongoing for 5 years and works under the direction of the State Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Mark Moran.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio with Native Christmas music. Then at 7, American Indian Airways with a walk to justice on the murder cartel state of indigenous peoples in southern Mexico. Tonight's weather, clear skies, down to a low just dipping below freezing to 28. Tomorrow's weather, mainly sunny, a high of 44. Today in history, we have some help from historian Dr. Chris Nichols to give us perspective on a very important part of our national dialogue. It's December 15th. In 1791, the U.S. Bill of Rights became law when it was ratified by the Virginia General Assembly. The U.S. Bill of Rights, obviously, we still are talking about it and arguing about what it does and doesn't cover today, right?
Yeah, right. Oh, so important. I mean, you know, arguably, the Bill of Rights was the single most important part of the Constitution. Because it lays out everything else that's needed to make the democracy function, right? You know, from think about your first 10 amendments, from your speech and your ability to worship without constraint by a government, to not establish, you know, religion, all the way down through thinking about all kinds of issues that we have, like Second Amendment rights, what does it mean to keep and bear arms, and on and on. You know, I think the big takeaway there for me, as we think about the ratification of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, December 15th, 1791, is that the framers and founders, as they debated the Constitutional Convention, as they drafted the Bill of Rights and put it up to the states for this ratification process, really understood this to be, in my view as a historian, a working document. And so, you know, if the Constitution were the only thing, you wouldn't have needed a Bill of Rights, right? And you need a Bill of Rights that then has a formal process by which you can amend it so that you can change the Constitution, so that you can add to, subtract from, right, the Bill of Rights over time as the nation evolves, as its people evolve, as its values evolve, et cetera. So in thinking about the Bill of Rights, I think about all the things that were not articulated early on, right? 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, the Reconstruction Amendments that reshaped what it means to be a citizen in the U.S., notably, you know, ending slavery and giving full freedoms to African Americans who had been enslaved, including, and most notably, of course, full citizenship rights to vote. But thinking also about 17th Amendment, the direct election of senators, I think people don't tend to ever think about that, right? But, you know, originally, as the Constitution was formed, the Senate was picked by state legislatures. It was all full of corruption and backroom deals and who you knew and networks. You know, so those are just a couple good examples of why you need to amend the Bill of Rights and what the Bill of Rights was meant to do to start with.
And thanks to Dr. Chris Nichols from Ohio State University for that commentary on today's date in history. The Federal Reserve raises interest rates. Survivors of the Club Q shooting testify before Congress on LGBTQ violence. And the House Coronavirus Subcommittee discusses preparations for the next health emergency. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2022 Talks.
The details of today's meeting, I'd like to underscore for the American people that we understand the hardship that high inflation is causing, and that we are strongly committed to bringing inflation back down to our 2% goal.
Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, announced interest rates will rise half a percentage point as part of a long-term strategic move to combat inflation. Powell pointed to price stability as a responsibility of the Fed, which serves as a bedrock to the economy. He added ongoing increases will be needed to ensure inflation gets to the Fed's goal of 2%. Matthew Haynes, the owner of Club Q in Colorado Springs, testified before the U.S. House Oversight Committee about anti-LGBTQ violence. He never imagined his bar being the target of the next hate crime. He hopes to work with local elected officials and community leaders in Colorado Springs to make LGBTQ events safe.
I know that we
our Club Q community are in the thoughts and prayers of so many of you. Unfortunately, these thoughts and prayers alone are not saving lives. They are not changing the rhetoric of hate.
Several immunology and public health experts testified before the House Coronavirus Subcommittee about preparing for the next public health emergency. Dr. Kizmikia Corbett, an assistant professor at Harvard University's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, said she wants the committee to revisit the good and the bad of the pandemic.
The truth is that while we would all like to put the pandemic behind us, one fact remains. The virus and the medical and social implications of it are here to stay. In fact, just in the past week in this country, we have averaged over about 60,000 cases per day.
Members of the House are slated to vote on a one-week stopgap measure to have more time to develop a budget for the federal government. Democrats have been trying to get the one-week continuing resolution passed, but it has little bipartisan support. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy criticized how Democrats have handled this year's budget process.
Talk of the majority right now who wants to put a small continuing resolution to bump all the members up 2 days before Christmas to try to vote on a package they cannot read, written by two individuals who will not be here, on spending for the entire government.
Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin announced a special election will be held to fill the Virginia 4th District seat. The seat was previously held by Representative A. Donald McEachin, who died on November 28th. The last day candidates can file to run is December 23rd. I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
An Oregon Casino Foundation offers $1 million in grants. California tribal leaders prepare to launch a new feather alert system, and the whitebark pine is now considered threatened. With these stories and more, here's National Native News.
Tribes in California are preparing for the implementation of the Feather Alert, which alerts the public when a Native person goes missing. The Feather Alert notification system is similar to the Amber or Silver Alerts, which are used when children are abducted or missing or when seniors are missing. Tribal leaders, state lawmakers, and others recently gathered in Coarse Gold, California to share input on the Feather Alert. Native American state lawmaker James Ramos co-sponsored the bill for the alert system. He says the roundtable was an opportunity for leaders to hear from each other, law enforcement, and others invested in addressing the issue of missing and murdered indigenous people.
This implementation roundtable discussion is meant to start to build that relationship, meant to build the questions that could be out there. How do we interact? How does the Feather Alert get implemented? And being able to have different speakers on panels here coming up is vital, but it's also vital to hear firsthand from tribal leaders, tribal chairs, tribal vice presidents of the issue that still drastically affects all California Indian people.
Ramos says California is the state with the greatest population of Native Americans in the nation and is also among states with the highest rates of reported cases of MMIP. The new Feather Alert system is intended to help law enforcement act more quickly in notifying the public and to help produce leads to find missing individuals. The Feather Alert bill was supported by a number of tribes, law enforcement groups, and Native health organizations. The public notification tool rollout will take place in January. The whitebark pine, which populates 80 million acres of the Mountain West, is now listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports on the newly afforded federal protections.
The whitebark pine is crucial to the Northern Rocky Mountain ecosystem. Its seeds are a key food source for several species of birds and for threatened grizzly bears. It also helps preserve high elevation mountain snowpack into the spring and summer months. But scientists estimate that a non-native fungus and other threats have eliminated up to half of the species. The Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes celebrated the move to provide federal protections, saying the tree is, quote, part of our first foods and culture, unquote. The tribes and conservation groups hope the tree's protected status will bolster efforts to plant fungus-resistant trees across the Mountain West. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
The charitable arm of the Three Rivers Casino has made an open call for nonprofits in several Oregon counties to apply for over $1 million in grant money. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
The Confederated Tribes of Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siosla Indians established the Three Rivers Foundation 11 years ago. It distributes casino profits to other groups in need. Coordinators are encouraging nonprofits in Lane, Curry, Coos, Lincoln, and Douglas counties to apply. Some government agencies and federally recognized tribes in Oregon are also eligible. Shelby Erickson is the foundation's grants administrator.
We typically look at different priorities when we receive applications, such as education, health, public safety, problem gambling, the arts, the environment, cultural activities, and even historic preservation.
Erickson says food shares and Boys and Girls Clubs have been recurring applicants. Last year's total grant distribution was $1.4 million, and she expects this year's amount to be similar. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Navajo Nation is bridging the gap between traditional knowledge and science in the fight against climate change. About 30% of the residents do not have running water or electricity in their homes. As Alex Gonzalez reports, indigenous communities are some of the most impacted by the climate crisis.
Climate change is taking its toll on tribal nations across Arizona, and some are bridging the gap between indigenous knowledge and Western thought to adapt to new realities. From droughts now synonymous with the Southwest, to flash floods, landscapes are changing. Keith Howard, a wildlife technician with the Navajo Nation's climate change program, says building trust within the community is essential for the program's efforts to succeed.
Finding a way to reach the people and communicate with them in respect to our traditional way of learning and our traditional ways of understanding how the world works is one of the biggest obstacles.
Howard says language barriers make it difficult to translate some climate-related concepts into indigenous languages, which can be especially challenging for community elders. Despite the difficulties, Howard says progress is being made. According to an international assessment of climate change released last year, indigenous communities are among the most susceptible to the effects of a warming climate.
One of our struggles is finding resources, funding opportunities to address some of these issues to help mitigate the effects of climate change.
I'm Alex Gonzalez.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 15th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Reed Johnson, Suzanne Potter, Mark Moran, Alex Gonzalez, and Mark Richardson. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public